Antonio Brown is finally a Raider, but how long will it take John Gruden's team to become competitive, and is Derek Carr going to be a part of it? Plus, Keenum to Washington, Eric Weddle, and the wacky safety market, the Jaguars stick with Leonard Fournette, and a free agent running back debate, Tevin or Le'Veon. The league new year is almost upon us, and we have plenty to talk about on the MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast. Hello and welcome to the MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast. I am Gary Gramling. He is Andy Benoit. Antonio Brown is a Raider. What do you think about that, Andy?
I'm glad it's done. I think that's the most tired I've gotten, most fed up I've gotten with one, even though it's a fascinating, because we don't see superstars get traded in their prime a whole lot. But it got to where after the Buffalo thing fell through, I didn't care where he went.
It was an obnoxious 48 hours because he was also teasing like, oh, it's coming any minute, it's coming any minute, which I'm sure is annoying for people who don't work in this industry, but it's especially annoying for us, and really this is all about us. It's especially annoying for us because then we have to be basically on call 24/7. I mean, I was like in bed last night when the trade went through and I had to get up and I had to tell you to write something and I had to tell Connor Orr to write something, and it was a mess. Ruined my life, Antonio Brown.
Yeah, in the middle of the night on daylight savings, we're already losing an hour, but that's okay. The other part that surprises me on this, and we're going to talk the football part in a minute. This kind of parlays into the football part. Does it seem to you like nobody is mentioning all the off-field stuff you get with Brown and the fact that he quit on his team in their biggest game of the season? They're saying, oh, he held out, he wanted more money, he's been on social media, he's causing a stir. Nobody has talked about the horrendous off-field accusations or the fact that, from a football standpoint, he committed the ultimate sin of walking out on his team in Week 17.
No, I think that's very true, and obviously we talked about it briefly a couple weeks ago, but that's kind of the thing with Antonio Brown. It's just a constant torrent of stuff. Good stuff and bad
stuff. But he's not getting
just so much.
They're not counting. Yeah, and the worst stuff's not getting counted. It's almost like we're starting at the lower stuff and grading them off that. Somebody close to the Steeler organization came up to me at the combine, and the phrase despicable human being was attached to Antonio Brown by that person.
Man, that's not mincing words right there. Well, now
good
he's
player,
a Raider.
Though. Good player.
Wonderful player, and as we've talked about, he probably has a couple of really, really good seasons, Antonio Brown-type seasons left here. Let's talk about his fit with the Raiders, though. I mean, the cupboard is bare in Oakland, soon to be Las Vegas. Right now, their playmakers are Antonio Brown, and that's about it. Martavis Bryant is suspended, and they have Seth Roberts is fine as your third or fourth receiver, I suppose. They don't have running backs. They have a left tackle if he progresses in Colton Miller. That's about it.
And they have a quarterback who I think they realize needs good situation around him in order to be comfortable. Carr and his pocket toughness and his willingness to turn it loose, it wasn't there last year, and my guess is if you got the Raiders in an honest moment, they'd say he needs weapons in order to be that kind of QB, and Brown's a starting point. He's not an end point, because as the roster is constructed now, and the idea that you can just double team and take away a receiver, that gets overblown at times, but if ever it were true, there are zero weapons around Antonio Brown. It's not like in Pittsburgh where he had other guys and he had a quarterback that's going to extend plays and see the field all the time. This is a tough situation. They need to, and I assume it's the first step. They've got a lot of draft picks. They have some extra cap space left. They need to keep going in that direction, because otherwise there's no point in getting Brown.
So I want to take this in two different directions here, and I'll start with this, and we're going to steal Connor Orr's thunder to an extent, but Connor Orr, I'm sure, is going to go nuts about this on Wednesday on the Albert Breer podcast with Albert and Jenny. He is skeptical of the John Gruden plan here. I think I feel comfortable categorizing him as having that take. But if you look back a year ago, one of the arguments for trading Khalil Mack was, hey, you can't have two guys on these monster franchise contracts with the state of the roster right now. We're not close, so we need to trade Khalil Mack, and we're going to get a return for Khalil Mack, and et cetera. And obviously, they got a significant return for Khalil Mack. What they got in draft capital, it's not Khalil Mack, probably, but it's something. It's valuable. But basically, they're making that same investment, not quite the same money, but they're making a similar investment in Antonio Brown at this point that they probably could have made in Khalil Mack a year ago. Similar.
That's
not
a great
same,
point.
Similar.
Yeah. That's a great point. And when you put it that way, that's the best argument against a trade. Because I know Connor's other point that I disagree with him on, but I understand where he's coming from, is that Brown's 31, and by the time, you know, the Raiders, by the time they get back to where they're hoping to be, Brown's going to be washing up, and those ages don't match up, and Brown's not going to be here to see the fruition of the rebuilding project. I disagree on that, which I assume that's the other thing we're going to talk about, is I do think, and you and I talked about a few weeks ago, Gary, I do think Brown will age more gracefully, and I don't think you have to worry about his age or washing up anytime soon. So that, to me, is on the other side, but the idea that, yeah, you essentially got Brown instead of Mac, I get some of that. Let's not forget, though, and you said it, but a couple of first-round picks for one guy, that's only happened 8 times in NFL history, and all 8 times it favored the team getting the draft, 7 times, we'll see what happens with Mac, but the previous 7 times, it favored the team getting the draft picks in the end.
No, that's fair. And obviously, the draft capital that they spent to get Antonio Brown was not very much, a third-round pick and a fifth-round pick. He gets the newish contract here, some more guaranteed money, $30 million. Basically, the rule of thumb is 3 years for contracts like this. However they're structured, they're almost always structured for 3 years, and then they go back and revisit it and restructure it, or they say, we don't want you anymore, and that's the end of it. But can I tell you my conspiracy theory?
Yeah, of course.
This will be complete nonsense and the worst part of the show, but I'm going to say it out loud anyway. And if it comes true, I'm going to take a ton of credit for it. And if it doesn't, then we'll just never speak of it again. I think the Raiders are going to draft a quarterback. I think they're going to, with their first pick in this draft, I think they're going to take a quarterback. I think they're going to try to pry that first pick away from the Cardinals. I don't know what's going on in the Cardinals front office. I can't imagine Steve Keim is thrilled at the prospect of trading Josh Rosen away for like a second round pick a year after he traded up to take him 10th overall. I think if you paired Antonio Brown for the next 3 years with a guy on a rookie contract, and obviously we talk about that all the time, the rookie wage scale, the rookie contracts, I think that makes a lot of sense from a team-building standpoint. You know, essentially, Brown is almost like your quarterback contract, and then your quarterback is on what would be a good receiver contract.
Yeah, I have heard that John Gruden does not think Derek Carr is very good. And I don't know John Gruden at all. I've been around him when he's evaluating players. This was years ago, though. And John Gruden doesn't think very many players are very good. He has a very high, and you'd never guess that because on Monday Night Football, every guy was amazing.
Yes.
But I would sit there and watch him rip these guys on film and then say great things on Monday Night Football. He's just playing the politics game there.
You
he
have to go back
doesn't
to
think
those
guys are very good players.
Those Monday Night Football broadcasts, you have to go back and just understand he's being sarcastic constantly.
Do you think it is? Well, I could see it. And it's a genius level of sarcasm because he knows it's almost like how animals can only hear a certain pitch, but we can't hear it. The really good football minds in the NFL can hear those high-pitched level of sarcasms, and the viewing audience at home has no idea that he's being sarcastic. Yeah, I think you're right about that.
Realistically, how far away are the Raiders at this point? I mean, obviously, like you said, ton of cap space, ton of draft picks. We don't know who they are going to get. We had talked all season how they needed to basically, you know, completely rebuild the defense. And now you're looking at the offense and saying, well, outside of your wide receiver and outside of your left tackle, your single wide receiver, I should say, and outside of your left tackle, and they're good on the interior line, but those guys have been there for a while. We'll see how much longer they last. But you have a lot of holes to fill here.
Absolutely. I mean, they don't look close, but we've learned this lesson too many times. The Rams a couple years ago and the Colts last season, you can get close very quickly in the NFL. The teams that are not close are not as far off as they ever appear to be. So that's the other part about Connor's argument about Brown is, oh, he won't be here when the roster does finally get to where it needs to go. I don't think any team views themselves as a 3-year rebuilding project. I think it's 1 to 2 years max for how they view it. So the Raiders, yeah, they're not close. They're not even close to close, but I wouldn't worry about that too much.
No, I think that's a really good point, Andy, that these rebuilds that we used to look at and say, boy, they're 3 to 5 years away. No one's 3 to 5 years away anymore. You're 1 or 2 years away if you do it right. The other question, Thursday night, were you surprised the Bills were in on this? These were just kind of surprising teams that were in on Antonio Brown.
Well, Gary, if you would listen to our MMQB Monday morning podcast, I think you would have heard Andy Benoit predicting it's going to be some team that we don't expect because Brown's such a wild card.
No, wait, that's not a prediction at all. Your prediction was you will be surprised. That doesn't count.
Yes.
You're like, who is the guy? Who's the guy who used to talk to dead people and it would just be, he would do the, what do you call that? I'm butchering it now, but.
Oh, I know who, you're, yeah.
The show.
I know what
you, Crossing over. Yeah, with, I don't. What's his name?
Okay,
that's
and you go
that
through the audience and you get him to say, "Yeah, okay, well, maybe." But you basically just asked me two questions ago if I'm surprised. I wasn't surprised the Bills were in it because I thought all along it would be someone we never expected.
Albert Breer reported it was more about the money than anything else, and Antonio Brown got the money. I mean, Antonio Brown basically he got his way on this. He seems perfectly happy joining a rebuild in progress here in Oakland, and I don't know. I don't know if Buffalo became an option if they were going to give him that kind of deal. It sounds like they weren't. Most guys don't want to go to Buffalo anyway, it seems, but just means more LeBiettes for the rest of us.
You know, on the last topic on Brown, at the Combine, one of the nights I was walking back to my room, I look across the Marriott hotel lobby, and they just have redone it, and it's very dark in there. So whatever you think you see, you're not quite sure you're seeing. I saw the outline of Richard Sherman just sitting by himself, messing around on his phone. So I approached slowly, and indeed it was Richard Sherman, and we wound up talking for 90 minutes, just going back and forth. He noticed that I had said he was looking washed up, and he gave me the break because the Achilles injury, but that was that was our icebreaker, actually. But he got into explaining to me what makes Antonio Brown so good. And this is what made me flip because we were talking, Gary, about when his speed and quickness diminishes, he's so dependent on that getting in and out of his breaks. That's what makes him so great now that if he loses 10% of that, is he going to lose a big portion of his game? Will he hit a wall? And your argument was that, well, he's also so good at making contested catches because he gets away with grabbing and little subtleties. And Sherman took me through all the stuff that Brown does. He demonstrated it on me. Grab my collar, grab my elbow. And his point, and it won me over because he's had the deal. He's covered the guy before, is he thinks Brown's going to age perfectly because that's what Brown's game is built on, is getting away with essentially little inflictions of pass interference on offense. And another coach told me Brown understands not just that stuff doesn't show up on film, so corners don't go in with a plan for it. Referees aren't seeing it, thinking we got to watch out for it. But B, Brown, he believes Brown knows where the officials are in relation to his route and at what point in his route he can get away with grabbing illegally, but it's going to essentially be legally because they can't see it, the officials.
That's interesting. I'd really be interested to talk to Antonio Brown about that after he retires at some point. But I think
I would too, actually. Even though I don't want to ever really know the guy, I am interested to know how in control. That's a genius element right there.
Yes,
and that's nothing physically. You wonder how can a sixth round pick be so successful in the NFL? That's the answer. And I wonder how aware he is indeed of that, or if it's just instinctive to him. My guess is he's more aware than people would imagine.
Well, I'll say this before we move on to the other stuff, but the one thing I think physically plays his advantage on that, I think the fact that he's 5'10", I think when you're a smaller guy, you can get away with that stuff. Whereas if he's a 6'3" guy doing that, it's bigger, it's more visible. At his size, I think it's easier to get away with that type of stuff.
The other guy who does it masterfully is DeAndre Hopkins, and the coach who told me that Brown explained that he thinks Brown does it without the officials seeing him. He said every week that they faced the Texans, they would send in 7 to 10 plays of DeAndre Hopkins alone, saying here are all the illegal things he's doing that you need to be on the lookout for, and referees never catch him either.
It's going to be a really fun couple of years. I was about to say in Oakland, and I'm very sorry to fans in Oakland, but it'll be a fun year in Oakland and then a two or three fun years in Las Vegas with Antonio Brown here, and I do think it's going to be either Kyler Murray or Drew Lock throwing in the ball. But forget I said that if it doesn't happen. Let's go to some of these other moves, the pre-free agency moves. We had talked about this show like on Wednesday. What were we going to talk about? We thought we were just going to like preview free agency, and then we had all these all these moves flood in. Everyone probably forgot the Redskins traded for a quarterback that was in demand a year ago. Case Keenum goes to Washington. Alex Smith obviously has the broken leg. It sounds like he's not going to be available in 2019, though obviously we will know more about that as we move closer to the season. But Case Keenum, we knew he was out in Denver once Joe Flacco was in. This the one thing I'll say, and no matter what you think of Case Keenum, the fact that they and I feel bad bashing Alex Smith, but I'll do it anyway. The fact that they gave up draft capital and a very big contract to Alex Smith a year ago, I don't know how you can get fired up negatively about Case Keenum going to Washington at this point, because they gave up basically nothing for him, and they're gonna pay him basically like $3.5 million for 1 year to come in there. I mean, yeah. It's as zero risk as you can get. He's actually on a good contract if he's a backup.
So here's my negative spin on it is that, and we don't know if this is viable because we don't know what's really going on in Arizona, but if they could have gotten Josh Rosen in a trade, even for that mm-hmm. number 15 overall pick, to me, that's a no-brainer. And I think Josh Rosen's a perfect fit for what they're doing. And we forget because Rosen had a down rookie year, but under circumstances that no guy would have thrived in. Rosen, if he were coming out now, he'd be viewed by many as the better prospect than Kyler Murray. And that's getting lost in this whole Kyler Murray to the Cardinals thing. Look, if the Cardinals love Murray, if they're truly head over heels, I get it, and go ahead and do that. That's why you've got that number one pick. But let's not, as I wrote, Gary, I probably have said this 8 times, and I'm pretty proud of the phrase. Let's not confuse the love for Murray with hate for Rosen, because there's nothing on Rosen's film to me that says he is any less of a prospect now than he was a year ago. And I thought he'd be perfect for Washington, so I was surprised when I saw the Keenum trade, because it indicates to me they're not going to go after Rosen.
I agree entirely, and it seems to be absolutely the consensus that Josh Rosen a year ago graded better among scouts than Kyler Murray does this year. Now, teams, look, we had everyone at the combine. Everyone was asking about it. The market does seem to be day two pick right now for Josh Rosen, and
which is incredible. That can't possibly be.
I don't know what kind of whispers are going around about him. I you know, obviously they had a lot of people leave that organization, and maybe people didn't have kind things to say about him. He was a guy who obviously had something of a unique personality coming out of the draft last year. That whatever you make of it. Different doesn't always play well with everyone, so it's a bizarre situation that the Giants should be in on this. They can take another offensive lineman, or God forbid they have a pass rusher there for the first time in like a decade with that number 6 pick. But let's get to Keenum real quick. I will say this. It might be the kind of thing they could still trade for Rosen. They could still take a quarterback in the draft. It doesn't preclude that any of that. It might end up being a Keenum versus McCoy type of situation, Colt McCoy, that is, for the backup job in Washington, and they'll get their next quarterback, and it's probably time for them to move on from the Alex Smith trade anyway.
So you think they're going to draft a QB still?
I don't. I wouldn't be surprised, but I don't. Let me put it this way.
Okay, Keenum versus McCoy for the backup job. Who do you think is the starter then?
You're going to keep one of them. You're going to keep Keenum or McCoy. It's going to be bridge slash. It depends on the quarterback you bring in, but it's going to be your bridge slash backup guy that you're bringing in between.
But why
Keenum
wouldn't
and McCoy?
You keep both of those guys if they're both affordable and it's already a competition? So you're not really over the moon about either of them because there's a competition in the first place.
You could do that too. Maybe you want to, I don't know, maybe you just want an even cheaper number 3 quarterback.
Are you tired of talking about Case Keenum? Not like right here, but like just overall.
We've talked about him a lot over the last 2 years. Look, he's warranted it. He's been a really interesting guy. He was great 2 years ago out of nowhere. He was not very good last year, and now he's just sort of looking for a home again. Poor Case Keenum.
Well, he's got a home. He's got found the home. I mean, unless you mean he's out shopping real estate. I assume he knows he's going to be a Redskin. We know what Keenum is, and he's a limited passer with a gunslinger mentality, and that's going to have ups and downs that come with it. He's very different than Alex Smith in that sense, and I bet you if you talk to people with the Redskins and you got them in an honest moment, they'd tell you they didn't love Alex Smith, his cautious approach. That left some opportunities out there, and we said all along, that's not an offense for a cautious QB. That's an offense for a decisive timing and rhythm quarterback, and you get more of that with Keenum than Smith. So I think Keenum actually stylistically can be an upgrade over Alex Smith, even though Alex Smith is probably viewed as the more stable QB overall.
Yeah, I mean, it's about fit at this point. If you're building a team from the ground up with no scheme, which would be a terrible idea, Alex Smith is probably your preference, but Case Keenum probably makes a little more sense for this Washington team. Let's keep it in the NFC East, Andy. A player traded for another player, Olivier Vernon, for Kevin Zeitler, the Browns guard. So let's start with the Giants side of this, because they were terrible in the trenches last year, and now they have – we knew they were bad in the offensive line, despite signing Nate Solder and drafting Will Hernandez early in the second round. They're still rebuilding that line. Zeitler is a good player. I mean, you figure Zeitler's got at least like three good seasons left in him of being a quality guard.
And I think guards are the fastest way to change the makeup of your offensive running game, because that's where you get your pull blocker. That's where any of your schemed runs involve the guard. They don't involve your tackles the same way. Centers can be in that guard. Interior offensive line. So I like adding Zeitler to Hernandez. Hernandez started coming along towards the end of last year. They're both on the move blockers. It's going to be a much more diverse running game with Zeitler and Hernandez there now than it would have been otherwise. So Saquon Barkley's getting better for you. So I think this move makes all the sense in the world for the Giants, and I understand it from Cleveland's side as well. I also think this trade is not nearly as big a deal as we made it out to be. This is a B-grade starter traded for another B-grade starter, and both will fit the context of their teams. They're not going to change the outlook of their teams, other than Zeitler does give the Giants more dimension in the ground game, and the trickle-down effect of that could be lucrative for New York.
Well, it's player for player, and it's two guys who got pretty big paydays in the last couple of years here. So that makes it something just slightly more interesting. This Giants defensive line is fascinating. They've now moved on from they traded Snacks Harrison. They moved on from Jason Pierre-Paul, and now Olivier Vernon is gone. I do want to ask you about Olivier Vernon really quick. He sets the edge well. We know that. He's now going to be in a situation where he is playing opposite Myles Garrett, which presumably creates some more opportunities. I remember when he came in last year, he missed the first portion of the season, and when he came in, I think it was a little more maybe fresh legs type of a situation, but he did make a little bit of noise as a pass rusher, and then he sort of faded and looked a little bit more like he has the last couple of years. But Olivier Vernon as a number two pass rusher, I mean, that seems like a pretty potentially solid player right there.
That's
in
a
the
strong
pass
take.
Rush,
wow.
In the pass rush.
I think
that is a take.
I think that's what he is. That's a B, and you just described a B grade player. Olivier Vernon is not an explosive outside moving edge bender. So there's a ceiling on his pass rush productivity right there, because if you can't bend the edge in the NFL, you're not going to be a 12 sack a year type of pass rusher. He's a great leverage player. He's a great technician. That's why he's so good in run defense. And I do think he can be a quality number two rusher, especially opposite a guy like Garrett, who's going to be getting more of the attention from chip blocks and double teams and protection slides. You're going to get some one-on-one scenarios for Vernon. So it is a good situation. But Browns fans, if you're thinking you've got bookend stud pass rushers now, you don't understand Olivier Vernon. That's not the kind of player he is.
Michael Bennett goes from the Eagles to the Patriots. So the Patriots basically, they're going to lose Trey Flowers here on free agency, and Michael Bennett becomes a pretty nice replacement in the short term.
I like that move. I don't love that they're losing Trey Flowers, but we've seen that's kind of been New England's approach before. We understand it. Remember when Dante Hightower was a free agent a few years ago and the Patriots basically told him, go out there, test the market, come back and tell us what your market is, and we'll see if we want to go above it and retain you or not, which is a nice way to do business, by the way. We don't think of the Patriots as great employers, but that's a great – if I'm a free yes. agent, that's exactly how I want my yeah. team to treat me. So I don't know if they're doing – my sense is they're not doing that with Flowers here. That's why they traded for Bennett. So it's a little bit of a downgrade, but when you factor in the cost, you know, this is the Patriot model. It works for him, and Michael Bennett, let's not get confused about his age. He can still play at the highest of levels.
Eric Weddle kind of caught us off guard when the Ravens severed ties with him, let him go. He goes to the Rams. I guess let's start with the Ravens side of this real quick because, I mean, this is a big deal. This is a guy – this is a diverse, disguise-based defense that was – I mean, it was as good as any defense in football last year, and Weddle seemed to be sort of the main cog to that.
And I wrote on Twitter that there have been about two dozen coaches that have told me this offseason alone, and it's a chunk of them are Ravens coaches, a chunk of them are AFC North coaches, and a chunk are just coaches who study teams around the league and the natural flow of their work. All these people are saying that Eric Weddle's a key to that defense in Baltimore and the key to their pass rush because his disguise doesn't just disguise coverages, it disguises Baltimore's blitz packages as well, and that's the big deal for the Ravens. So I wrote that on Twitter, and someone said, oh, don't exaggerate. It's not two dozen people, and I normally don't see that stuff or certainly respond to it, and I started to on this one, and then I realized the gentleman who said it, I think he spelled exaggerate E-X-A-G-I-O-R-A-T-E, which phonetically is pretty good, but, you know, realistically, it's horrible.
That's
so I didn't wind up responding
stuff,
to him.
Yeah.
That's exactly what it is. I didn't respond to him, but I promise you, I am not exaggerating. There's been about two dozen coaches that have told me Eric Weddle's the guy in Baltimore. So when he got released, I thought, man, that doesn't make any sense at all. But then when you think about who's available at safety, what those coaches are really saying, because a lot of those coaches also said Eric Weddle doesn't run well, he's not a mm-hmm. great tackler in space anymore, and he can't cover man-to-man. So you got to hide him behind Tony Jefferson and some of the things you do in Baltimore. So what they're really saying is not so much that Weddle's amazing, it's that the safety position to the Ravens is excruciatingly valuable to them. And look at all the safeties who are available, not just safeties, but guys that are multi-dimensional. Landon Collins, Tyrann Mathieu, Adrian Amos to a certain degree. Even Earl Thomas can play back in center field or down in the box. So I believe the Ravens made this move because they want to find their safety for the next 4 years. And Weddle at this point, though still great within the context of their scheme, he's a year-to-year player right now.
They're in that window. They're in the rookie contract quarterback window. I got to come up with a better phrasing for that. Were you surprised, another one, Landon Collins? I mean, you know, you're very familiar with James Betcher and what he does. Were you surprised that they moved on from Landon Collins in New York?
Yeah, I was. I bet you Betcher was a little bit surprised, too. That's a guy they need in their scheme. Betcher wants to blitz. He, too, wants to disguise. When you're a blitz team, you tend to be a disguise team. Collins was a valuable piece, and he gave him someone who could match up to tight ends. And in the NFC, that's a big NFC East. That's a big deal. You have to have an answer for Zach Ertz, and then assuming he's healthy, which might be a big leap sometimes. But Jordan Reed, you got to cover those guys for at least four games out of the year, and that's just your mm-hmm. divisional games. Collins was not that guy early in his career, and he evolved into that guy. So I am surprised that the Giants are moving on from him.
No, it's a really fascinating safety market here, and Weddle obviously off the board to the Rams now, and he'll be a veteran there, and I guess they're moving on from LaMarcus Joyner is what that signifies there, but yeah. So what we had originally planned for the show, we were actually going to do some head to heads with some of the free agents out there. So if you had, we'll do a little preview, and we will do some of these, including we'll get to Andy's Le'Veon Bell versus Tevin Coleman take. But like a Landon Collins versus an Earl Thomas versus a Tyrann Mathieu, obviously it depends on what your system is. Which guy in this day and age is going to be more valuable, especially considering Collins is a young guy. Matthew, I guess you'd kind of call him middle age. Thomas, you might say, is a little bit on the back end, and also as a free safety that might matter a little bit more because you know, as good and instinctive as he is, once he loses a half a step, that does affect your range.
Yeah, sure, it does. Do you think Thomas can still play at a premium level? We need to start there.
Yes, he's also, I mean, you know, he's also coming off an injury. Based on what we saw early last year, I would say yes.
Yeah, and I would too. He's going to be in his very early 30s this season. That's not old for, remember, safeties, especially free safeties, you're not taking as many hits over the course of your career. Your wear and tear is not the same as if you're a Cam Chancellor and you're always coming down in the box. So I think Earl Thomas is still Earl Thomas. The question is, will teams around the league view him that way? This gets back to that tight end discussion we had a few weeks ago, Gary, where the teams that know how to use the tight end, they use them extremely well, and those tight ends become very valuable to those teams. But maybe 12 to 15 teams in the league truly know how to use the tight end. The rest, they just plug them in, and that's where the tight end goes. They're not moving them around. They're not formationing them. They're not leveraging them schematically. Yeah. A little bit the same with safety. The teams that, like Baltimore, that use them really use them well, but there are a lot of teams that just line up and play, and they plug their safeties in, and that's where the safety goes, and that's the extent of it. So that's why the safety market's so fascinating. That's part of the reason I think last year it got depressed when we didn't expect it to, is safety's valuable big time, but not to every team, which keeps the market price down. It's less bidders. So, and with Earl Thomas, Collins, Matthew, you've got that force working in one direction, and then the other force is coverage versatility. And I think Matthew's a distant third between those guys, for example.
Yeah.
I do. I don't think he's the same guy he was in Arizona, and he had some blown assignments in Houston last year, and maybe that's a coincidence in Houston. It's not an easy scheme to play, and Matthew's never been viewed as a less than intelligent player. He's actually a very smart player, so maybe it's all just a aberration. But I think Matthew is not the guy he was a few years ago, but he can cover the slot, and those other two guys cannot. So it is a matter of which teams will use which guys, but the teams that need Matthew, they might not need Landon Collins. So that also, what does that do for the market?
Yeah, it's going to be messy out there. The other thing I'll say in defense of Tyrann Mathieu, they were kind of a mess in the secondary last year, and they had a lot of, you know, Aaron Coleman didn't work out. They were short on talent around them, and it was a lot of new faces, and it just didn't really quite work out from a chemistry standpoint. But look, we were stunned by the fact that, you know, not only Eric Reed, but you know, the guys who sat out, whether it be Kenny Vaccaro or Morgan Burnett, these guys who lasted out there on the market forever last year. So
Trey Boston, they're all back out there too. Burnett's with Pittsburgh still, but I bet you they would replace him if they knew they could, because they need someone more durable. And then Vaccaro and Boston are back on that same market. Eric Reed would have been as well, but he got his deal signing in Carolina.
Yep. Carlos Hyde to the Kansas City Chiefs. So you'll have a Carlos Hyde, Damian Williams tandem in the backfield there. I mean, that's nice. We got to get to the Jaguars stuff in a second, but that's nice to have Carlos Hyde in Kansas City.
I think Carlos Hyde's a good player, a really good player, and I don't know what has happened around him over the last couple of seasons to make that point lost on so many people, including the teams that are signing him and then letting him sit on the bench.
Well, let's talk about what the Jaguars did. Jaguars cut a bunch of guys, Hyde among them, also Malik Jackson, Tashaun Gibson would probably be the headliners there. We presume they're making way for, you know, clearing some space for Nick Foles at this point, which we expect to happen early in free agency. But you really, really don't like the fact that Carlos Hyde is out and Leonard Fournette is still there in Jacksonville.
Well, what kind of message does it send? Leonard Fournette, is a week-to-week proposition. You don't know if he's going to show up and play hard for you or not, and you don't know if he's going to be healthy or not. Maybe those two things relate. You don't know if he's going to be focused and mature or not. You don't know. There's a lot of just, it's a toss-up with Leonard Fournette, and then when on days that you do get him, he's a really good power runner, which is nice, but that doesn't change any of your playbook. That just means your four-yard runs become six-yard runs. Maybe one of them becomes a 15-yard run, and again, there's some value to that, but it's not like the Alvin Kamara factor, where you take on a whole different shape offensively just by having him on the field. So Fournette's a one-dimensional, up-and-down, week-to-week player with serious maturation issues, and you chose that guy over Carlos Hyde, who I don't know, but I assume is a pro's pro. We've never heard anything otherwise. So I just don't understand what kind of message it sends to the rest of your team that that's the direction you're going in, that Leonard Fournette's, who were the people that are raking the Jags over the coals because they chose Blake Bortles last offseason, then they fired Nathaniel Hackett and Bench Bortles together, and the whole thing blew up. Remember, the guys that did that, Doug Marrone, Tom Coughlin, they also chose Leonard Fournette a year ago and decided that's who we're building the offense around, and that has been every bit the disaster that the Blake Bortles experiment was, probably even much more of a disaster, in fact.
Well, it seems like they're still going in that direction, though, and that's why you'd,
yes,
you'd keep Fournette. Fournette is a you know, as you mentioned, he's a better runner. I don't know why everyone sees Carlos Hyde at this point as a guy who can't catch the ball at all. I'm not saying he's a you know, he's Le'Veon Bell out there, but he can catch the. He had some like 59 catches 2 years ago. He's not a guy you're gonna do a lot of creative stuff with, but the ball's not gonna bounce.
Which is
off
not
his
true
hands.
With Fournette, by the way.
Yes.
Yeah, and if Fournette out in space, I had one coach put it to me: when you put him in space, and he's uncovered, he's a 50-50 proposition for catching the ball still, which doesn't give a coach a lot of confidence to design stuff with their running back in the passing game.
Oh man. Jaguars. I don't know if Nick Foles lands
this
there.
One blows my mind. This one blows. There
it
are
blows
10,000 other Leonard. Yes, there are 10,000 Leonard Fournettes on the planet right now. You can sign a B grade version of Leonard Fournette and be the same offensively in the big picture as you were with Leonard Fournette himself.
I just think they've already made the investment, and they're giving him a second chance here, and we'll see how it plays out. That's how they built it. I think the bigger criticism is how they built the thing in Jacksonville, and you know, I know a lot of people think we're going to see some full circle type of thing where we're going to get back to big offensive lines and power running backs, and that's how we're going to overpower these teams, and I think that can be an aspect of an offense, but the way the rules are in 2019, that doesn't really seem to be maximizing your opportunities to score points.
Well, and the coordinator you just hired doesn't view the world that way either.
Yes.
Let's keep that in mind. John DeFilippo's here because he specifically did not have that view in Minnesota.
That's going to be a fun year for DeFilippo and potentially Nick Foles there. Two more. These are minor impact, but these are two guys who had some moments in their last stops. Steelers do trade Marcus Gilbert to Arizona. He was a guy who he's had some injury problems, had a suspension, but you know, he's been a pretty solid lineman when he's been on the field.
I think this trade is more about Matt Filer played well off the bench for Pittsburgh as a rookie, and then they Okorafor, as Gary explained to me last year, third-round pick. They've got other options at right tackle, so they just didn't – there was no point in them paying and dedicating all that finance to Marcus Gilbert. I don't think this is a condemnation on Gilbert at all. He's a solid right tackle, and he's worth his contract, just not to Pittsburgh, so they sent him elsewhere. Arizona badly needed him, by the way.
I was going to say it's nice to get some help up front if you're the Cardinals at this point. And David Irving has, I guess you'd call it, retires. He's gonna partake in other things.
Yeah, now, I don't,
David,
I don't care
Irving,
about David
Irving.
Irving
had some moments on the field over the last couple of years. What if you lose David Irving and DeMarcus Lawrence?
No, that's you're right, but he's chosen to quit, and he was unavailable for much of last season. He's not an NFL player anymore, so I'm not going to ever think about him again.
Randy Gregory, too.
Gregory still is a player, and you're rooting for him and hoping the best for him, and that situation has always been a little bit worse than people realize, and the fact that they're still standing by him tells you that he's probably got some character they believe in. He's just got some demons that he's struggling with. So I hope things work out for Gregory. I know he hasn't been a sack master, but you could see the talent whenever he's on the field. And the fact you could see it when he's been away for so, remember, he was gone for, I think, over a year, wasn't he, Gary?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he's been suspended multiple times at this point.
Yeah. And when he steps on, it does not take, you can see he's rusty, but you can still see the talent. So there's a lot to. Yeah. Root for with Randy Gregory, but he's hanging in there. He's not choosing to walk away and live a different life like David Irving chose.
All right. So we will obviously have plenty of free agency reaction next week on the Monday show. I'm sure the Wednesday guys, Albert and Jenny and Connor, will have plenty of reaction as well as these signings start coming in. Should have noted at the top of the show, we're taping at like 4 o'clock on Sunday, 4 o'clock Eastern. So if anything insane happens Sunday night, you're just not going to hear it on this show. Sorry.
I don't mean to toot my own horn, but Gary Grambling's idea, folks, was to tape on Friday. I think it was more convenient to his schedule. He wanted to be a father to his children over the weekend. And I said, no, Gary, we have to give our Sunday to our listeners because there's going to be news happening. And reluctantly, he agreed.
Matt Havia. Matt Havia was the one who it wasn't his. We had just sort of thrown out Friday. Like 2 weeks ago, we threw out Friday because Andy, as everyone knows, last week bailed on the show, and Jenny Brentis had to step in for him. So when I talked to Matt Havia over at Cadence 13, and we had originally said Friday, and then this is like the most boring story ever told on this. And I've told some boring stories. But then we texted, and I was like, Matt, how about Sunday? And you know what he said? Okay.
But you texted him that after I emailed you and said it has to be Sunday,
Gary.
By the way, I heard your intro last week on my way into the Indianapolis airport. I turned it on. It's 6 in the morning. No, 5 in the morning Eastern time. I thought, I wonder what Gary said about me in the intro. And you called me a coward.
And, well, we also made fun of you at the end of the show, too. So
I didn't get to the end of the show. When you called me a coward, I turned it right off. I was particularly disappointed in Jenny Vrentes, my dear friend, not coming to my defense on that, just letting it slide.
She was nodding vigorously as I said.
Did you do the Zoom with her? Like we see our listeners know we see each other now, and Gary's wearing a soccer shirt today for some reason. Did you do the Zoom with her so you could see her as well?
We were both in studio. I was in New York on Sunday, so we met
really?
Up there. Yeah. Yeah, Sean Cherry was there with his dog. Sean Cherry, one of the producers, was over at Cadence, had his dog in the studio for the entire episode. Dog didn't make a sound. Really good dog.
That's good.
Pepper. Great dog. But at the end of the show, I made the point, Jenny's voice, and this was what threw me off very, very early in the show, Jenny's voice is so much softer than yours. You are yelling at me constantly, and I'm told I
yell when I talk football, and it's embarrassing. I do that, so I agree with you. And she's got a soft yet rich voice. It's very
yes.
NPR-ish, and I listened to it, and that's part of the reason I didn't keep listening, because I knew right away, oh, the show, from a pure audible standpoint, it sounds better with Jenny than with me, and that didn't sit well, so I turned it. Nothing I can do about that.
It is. That was the descriptor. NPR-esque is how Jenny Vrentis does it. And before we jump ahead here, Andy, we got to mention this is happening during our taping. Kelechi Osemele and a 6th-round pick to the Jets for a 5th-round pick is what the trade is. So not a whole lot of return for Kelechi Osemele at this point. I mean, he's 29 years old. He's expensive. But he can still play. This is the Raiders and the Jets making a deal.
And it's the Raiders. They were going to release him, and his cap number is about $10 million. And they decided, well, we might as well just trade our 6th up for a 5th instead of releasing him, and the Jets are willing to take on the contract. So this is the Raiders getting rid of Osemele's price tag.
So I know.
Which is odd when you think about it, isn't it? It's a little bit strange given how they're – I guess they don't have all the cap room in the world. I was thinking they have more than they do, but they got to pay Antonio Brown now.
They have a lot of cap room. We talked last year. Cash flow was an issue for them, so maybe this plays into that a little bit. But this is surprising. So now one more question mark on the Raiders offense, and I guess I'm not sure if I have to rethink my Raiders are definitely taking a quarterback take.
I don't think you would have to rethink that. What? Remember, the Jets are now Adam Gase's offense, and Adam Gase is an outside zone running coach. That's how he wants to play. And James Carpenter, who's a free agent, he does not have the lateral movement skills to play that way. He is a north and south mover, a Semele who's very good on north and south movement. He's a mauler, but he can also still go left and right. So this position is more valuable to the Jets because of the nature of their scheme, left guard. That position's more valuable to them than it is to the Raiders. So I understand why they're doing this. The Jets still have other work on their O-line, though. They need a center. They need probably a new right guard. Brian Winters is very average. And that's probably about it. I think they're decent enough at left tackle with Kelvin Beachum and then right tackle Brandon Schell. So it's one of many steps that the Jets are going to take to cater this offense to Gase.
All right. Well, let's go on to the regularly scheduled programming now that we have that news break out of the way. Let's get to these free agency head-to-heads. We're going to look at two players at, three different spots here. And we're just going to, we're just going to discuss them. I don't know if this will be a debate. We might agree. We might disagree. We're about to find out. The first one, and this was, people treated this as Andy's spiciest takes. I think it's a fairly mild take. But Tevin Coleman versus Le'Veon Bell at running back, and who do you want at this point? And I thought Andy wrote a very good justification of this once he went wider on it.
Because I want Coleman. And this was the other discussion I had the most at the combine with coaches. It was the Ravens defense, because coaches always bring up that defense and how good it is at scheming. And then it was the Coleman versus Le'Veon Bell debate, because when you get into this, into the weeds of this debate, you really are debating what we value in a running back. And to a man, here's what all the coaches agreed with, and I'll get to the part where then the conversation shifted into different opinions. To a man, though, everyone agreed Coleman's the better outside zone runner. Bell's the better inside runner, which would include gap scheme or man-to-man blocking. So think pull blockers, power, counter, those kind of runs, that patience that you see with Bell setting up blocks inside. He's much better than Coleman, but Coleman's better outside. As receivers, Bell's the better receiver, but both are much better than the linebackers they face. So do you really need to pay the premium for Bell when he's great at it, when Coleman, who's very good at it, can very good be good enough for what you do with your running back in the passing game? And almost every coach said, yeah, you know what? I think it can. I think we can, especially when you consider Coleman's going to cost a lot less than Bell, I think we can go with Coleman instead of Bell. The coaches that had the argument against that, though, this is where it differed. They said Coleman's a one-cut mover, so slant routes or drag routes, one direction and go. Bell can go in multiple directions as a route runner, so he can run pivot routes, option routes. You can do more with Bell's routes than Coleman's, and to some teams, that little bit of difference, that value of doing more with Bell, that makes Bell worth it. So that was kind of the discussion. I'd say more people in the NFL would take Coleman over Bell when you factor in the price of each guy. Bell's going to cost more, but they're not the same player at all. They're very system-driven as runners.
Well, who do you like? If price is not a factor, you still prefer Coleman a little bit.
If I'm running an outside zone scheme, which most teams in the league, probably 20 of them, that's their foundation mm-hmm. in the running game. So I think I would go Coleman, yeah. He's also younger, and I know Bell sat out last year, but Coleman's got less wear and tear. I do think Coleman is a 1-2 punch guy, and Bell's a bit more of a workhorse. Yeah. But I also think that gets overrated. Just go find the other punch for Coleman then. Find another. You can draft someone in the middle rounds or a good, solid journeyman 25-year-old running back. You can complement him with Coleman, and as long as they're different stylistically, I think it's fine.
I'll ask you two things off this. How much does it worry you? Coleman has never had 200 touches in a season. How much, obviously, we call it a, we say it's a plus that he still has plenty of tread left on the tires and that sort of thing. But how much does it worry you? Because we're actually having a similar conversation. Well, we're not. And actually, I don't know if anyone else is, but I'm saying this. Josh Jacobs, who is the best running back out of Alabama in this draft class, he's a guy who I think only had 20 carries in a game once at Alabama. They had a committee. How much does it matter? You might not be able to give Tevin Coleman the ball 20 times a game for 10-year games this week.
I think it matters because that correlates to how much he's on the field. Remember, when they're not touching the ball, the defense doesn't know they're not going to touch the ball, and the defense still has to have a plan for those guys, especially if you're moving them all over the formation. So that it matters a little bit, but I don't know if it matters as much as people think. The fact that Le'Veon can carry the ball and touch a lot more than Coleman, as long as you can find the number two guy to go with him, and most people can, most teams can, it's not Le'Veon versus Tevin Coleman. It's Le'Veon versus Tevin Coleman and another guy. Mm. And usually that other guy is going to be just fine. So I still go with the Coleman side of that. But I'm a Le'Veon guy too. I loved Le'Veon Bell when I last saw him 2 years ago.
How much does the closer aspect, the Kira Sedgwick as the closer, coming in and finishing games the way we saw the Patriots do in the Super Bowl this year, where you need a 4-minute drill, Le'Veon might be a little more of that back than Tevin Coleman is.
That matters. Kira said that. I remember that. Remember the year the Mavericks upset the Warriors, or no, Warriors upset the Mavericks, excuse me, in first round of the NBA playoffs.
Yes.
I think it's 2007, the Baron Davis-led Warriors. That's the year the closer came out, and that Kira Cedric commercial would always come on around, well, a lot of those games, but especially in the fourth quarter when I was really watching. It was a TNT show, and they would, the song Ain't No Sunshine, Ain't No Sunshine,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
She's got, that would come on with it, and it would never leave my head. I hated that. I both loved and hated that song. And now that song's in my head just by you mentioning a 4-minute offense with Kira Cedric.
There you go. That's what we do around here. Linebacker, this one's fascinating to me. C.J. Mosley versus Anthony Barr is the matchup we're going to talk about here. You like C.J. Mosley in coverage. A lot of people are very critical of C.J. Mosley's play in coverage. You like him as a zone coverage guy.
In certain zone coverages, the further he gets downfield, he's not a fast player. And so he gets left and right. He goes horizontally okay because he's aware and he knows what he's doing. But just from a physical standpoint, he's not super fast. So if you have him play Tampa 2, for example, where the middle linebacker's running with the most vertical inside receiver, that's not a great coverage for Mosley. I think that's why the Ravens played a lot less Tampa 2 this past year. So I like Mosley in the right scenario, but Anthony Barr is the same way. He's not always the best in coverage. The Rams got him on some vertical routes. Other teams did too early last season. Barr's the more physically gifted player, and Mosley's the smarter player, and I would go with Mosley because I think physically they're not super far apart.
I have a question about Anthony Barr. A lot of people are making the point that look, when he was coming out of UCLA in the draft, a lot of people saw him as a 3-4 outside linebacker rush guy. He was effective in limited snaps as a pass rusher in Minnesota as a blitzer. And, there have been reports that the Jets are very interested, that the Lions are very interested, teams that maybe would be willing to use him a little more as a pass rusher. Do you think there's something to that? Do you think he could be almost reinvented would probably be overstating it, because you're not going to completely change his role at this point. He's been very good at what he did at Minnesota, but can you see him basically becoming more of an impact pass rush guy somewhere else in a different system?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. It would have to be that 3-4-4-3 thing gets overblown, but it would have to be in a 3-4 where there's kind of an – because you do play a little tighter to the line of scrimmage at times in the 3-4 as the edge guy than you do in a 4-3. And I think Barr would have to be that kind of guy. My guess, Gary, because not only did he not do that, he never did that. They never put him on the edge in any of their packages at any point in his career. Coaches tell you how they feel about players by how they're using them, so that has to take into consideration. Mm-hmm. But you're right. I mean, that was the book on Barr coming out of UCLA, and he never got the chance, so we don't technically know what he is there. My guess is he's Derek Morgan on his best day, though, for the Titans, and not the Derek Morgan that had 15 sacks that 1 year or whatever it was when he was in a true 4-3. The Derek Morgan that's been in that Titans-style 3-4 the last several years. I bet he's that kind of pass rusher.
Okay. And last one, Ronald Darby at cornerback, one of my favorites, Pierre Desir. I guess more than anything, I'm just really curious, what is the market for a guy like Pierre Desir at this point, who he seems very much limited to a certain scheme, but he was great in that scheme last year.
He was, and that scheme in Indianapolis had a lot of cover two in it, and that's where Desir, he's good at jamming you, and when you play cover two, that's where you can be your best as a jammer because you have a safety over the top of you, and you're in zone coverage, so you're not worried about the wide receiver running by you because he's going to run by you by design. So in that kind of scheme, Desir can be good. Most teams, though, they're going to play a variation of some sort of man and matchup coverage, but Desir was solid, very solid in that as well. Darby is more of an off-coverage reader of the ball, plant and drive on your route. Desir wants to take away your route. So now it just gets into philosophy and scheme and what you're expecting of your cornerbacks there. If I got to build my own scheme and pick the guys I want, I would take the Desir type and have man-challenging corners, physical press corners, but that's a philosophy thing. There are plenty of teams that could take the off-coverage corner, and Darby's very good at that.
So, I mean, it's going to be fascinating because Desir, you think the Colts would want him just because he really had his way with DeAndre Hopkins last year.
Absolutely. Yeah, he won that match. Did he guard Hopkins all three times that those teams play? I don't remember what happened in the first game.
I can't remember the first one either, but he drew him in the playoff game. He drew him the second matchup too, and he won both those matchups.
In the playoff one, he won quite thoroughly, and that was a big deal in that game. If I'm the Colts, I know the Colts, they would love to have him back. So then it becomes a function of price and Indianapolis. So they've got the caps, but I would imagine they'll want Desir back.
Okay.
They have to pay Kenny Moore though. Remember that. Kenny Moore's going to get a big contract here very soon, probably before this offseason's over.
My last question for you, Tyrell Williams, who everyone seems to think is very much going to get paid. Albert Breer was asking around at the combine and checking in with people, and everyone seems sort of just accepting of the fact that Tyrell Williams is going to get a fairly significant contract here. He's just always been a really interesting guy because physically a really good talent. You would see some hiccups, some communication-type issues with him and Phillip Rivers early in his career, but he rounded into a really good player, and obviously, like I said, physical talent is very impressive with him.
Absolutely. Up and down player, probably the simpler your scheme, the better off he'll be, would be my guess, which is going to be true of every guy, but especially true in his case. It doesn't surprise me that people were telling that to Albert because we've seen what Tyrell Williams is, and he's got just that kind of talent that every team thinks if we get him with our wide receiver coach and in our system, we can harness that and get a 1,200-yard player. He's probably a 900-yard type wide receiver, a good quality number two, but he's going to get paid like a lower end to mid end number one for sure.
Yeah.
Every year there's two or three of those guys, isn't there?
There is. No, it's good for him for getting paid here, and it was fun seeing the depth with that Chargers receiving core, but can't keep them all, I guess.
And that's, I would keep Mike Williams over Tyrell Williams head-to-head as well, so yeah. I like what the Chargers are doing there.
All right, Andy, that's a wrap. I hope you do plenty of tampering this week because it's all going to be legal Monday, Tuesday.
Yeah, that'll be fun. What's wound up happening, because we've talked about this coming up with how we're going to cover free agency at MMQB this week, is this tampering period just turns into the new free agent period. There's reports that come out of this team signing that team, and we have to, in the media, we're going to treat that like it's happening, like that's official, just like we've treated all these trades as official, even though they're not official yet. So I think free agency starts Monday, and the news will probably start rolling in by no later than Tuesday.
Yep. So you want to be sure to subscribe to the MMQB podcast family because Albert Breer, Jenny Brentis, Connor Orr will have plenty of that on the Wednesday show. And then Andy and I will have plenty more next Monday when we recap a lot of these signings here. But that's going to be a wrap for now. Thanks to researchers Reed Foster and Ryan Taylor for making it sound smart. Thank you to producer Terrence Malangone filling in this week. All those guys at Kings 13 every week make us sound good. Most of all, thank you to you guys for listening to this episode of the MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast. You are the best. Like I said, Wednesday show, you're not going to want to miss it. And we will be back next Monday. Send any mailbag questions you might have. We will have a mailbag soon. talkback@themmqb.com, Twitter or Facebook, and subscribe. Subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts, including the mmqb.com, si.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, radio.com/10things, TuneIn, and other podcast providers. We will see you guys next week.